Welcome to another episode of Jamaican Gangster. On today's episode, we are featuring Ranking Dread. If you are not following us, we would be honored if you would consider doing so. It costs you nothing to hit that button, so that you will be notified every time we release a new episode. Now, let's get into it. The crowd at the club does not notice the man watching from the back of the room. They are facing the stage, shoulders moving, smoke hanging low near the ceiling. The bass from the speaker stacks hitting their chests the way bass hits in London reggae rooms in 1979. Not heard, felt. The DJ on the microphone is brilliant. He rides the rhythm with a slurring, interjecting voice that turns ordinary words into something the crowd takes personally. He gets a laugh. He gets a cheer. He gets the whole room moving in a single direction. The man watching from the back sees something different. He does not see a performer. He sees a key. The name on everyone's lips in that room is Ranking Dread. And the question that nobody standing in that room is asking yet, but that history will spend the next 15 years trying to answer, is this: who sent him here? And what was he really sent to do? He was born Winston Brown, somewhere in Trelawny Parish, Jamaica, in the mid-1950s. His family ended up in Kingston, and Kingston meant Rima and Tivoli Gardens, the two most politically contested garrison communities on the island. Growing up between those two communities was not a neutral education. It was an apprenticeship in loyalty, fear, and the physics of power. You learned early that the wrong lane, the wrong color on the wrong night could end you before you turned 20. Some said he was drawn into JLP political activism as a teenager, carrying the tribe's flag the way young men in garrison communities carried it. Not always by choice, but by geography. Rema and Tivoli had made him, and Tivoli did not produce soft men. By the mid-1970s, he had built a name on the re-symbolic sound system. Sound system culture in Jamaica in that era was not entertainment. It was infrastructure. The selector and the DJ controlled what a community heard, what it felt, what it believed about itself on a Saturday night. A man who could hold a microphone on re-symbolic was a man who understood crowd psychology, performance, and the power of a room's attention. Ranking Dread understood all three before he was 25. The music stopped. The man remained. He left Jamaica in the late 1970s. Exactly why he left depends on which version you believe. What is confirmed is that by 1978 he had arrived in London, and he had not come to disappear. He came with a name, and he knew how to use it. He found his entry point in the place every serious Jamaican musical talent in Britain found it. Lloyd Cox's own sound system, one of the most respected in the country, an institution in the British Caribbean community that predated reggae's rise to mainstream attention. Getting on that microphone for Lloyd Cox's was not a step down. It was a credential. It told the Jamaican community in London that this man had been verified by someone they trusted. He was brilliant. The crowds responded the same way they had responded in Kingston. That slurring, interjecting DJ style was unusual enough to stand out and familiar enough to feel like home. He recorded. His single Lots of Loving moved through UK reggae rooms in 1979 and 1980 with serious force, driven by rhythms from Sly and Robbie and the warm production touch of Sugar Minot. He followed it with Fatty Boom Boom in the early 1980s, which reached the lower edges of the national charts. For a brief period, the British music press was writing his name without fear in it. He knew exactly how long to let that last. By the mid-1980s, Ranking Dread had made a decision that nobody in the British music press saw coming, because they had not been watching the right rooms. The microphone was not gone. It was cover. While he was performing for audiences who thought they were watching a musician build a career, he had been building something else entirely. From a base in Stamford Hill and Stoke Newington in North London, the geography had shifted from stage lights to side streets, from a crowd that cheered to a community that had learned quietly what his presence in a neighborhood meant. The music stopped. the man remained. The streets of Hackney in the mid-1980s carried a particular kind of tension for the Jamaican and Caribbean communities settled there. Hackney was not wealthy. The housing was compressed. The lanes between blocks held a specific weight on summer nights. The sound of a yard going quiet when the wrong man walked through was not a metaphor. It was a social signal. People who lived in those streets knew, before any police press release, before any newspaper headline, which corners had changed and why. The children who grew up on those roads knew Rankin Dredd's name before most of them knew the name of the Home Secretary. That is what presence means when it operates at street level. It does not require a press conference. It spreads the way heat spreads through a zinc roof lane in August, slow, total, and impossible to ignore once it reaches you. By this point, he was running a drug dealing and armed robbery operation out of Hackney. British police wanted him in connection with a catalog of serious crimes, including murder. He moved under aliases. The name Errol Codling was the one he used most consistently, but there was also Michael Dix and likely others. The aliases were not carelessness. They were architecture. A man operating at that level in that era in London understood that identity itself was a tool, and Rankin Dredd had been performing identities his entire adult life. Some reported a connection to the Shower Posse, the Jamaican criminal organization with roots in Tivoli Gardens that had already established itself across the United States. Some accounts linked him to Claude Massop, the Tivoli Gardens Don, whose name carried enormous weight in Jamaica in the late 1970s before his assassination in 1979. Whether Rankin Dredd was operating as part of a wider structure with instructions coming from somewhere larger than Hackney, or whether he had built his UK operation through his own ambition and the relationships he had gathered across a decade of garrison life, is the question that never fully closed. The structure above him was never publicly confirmed. The operation below him was visible to everyone. And there it is again. That question planted in that room in 1979, watching from the back. Who was above him? Who benefited from having a man this capable, disconnected to both the music community and the street, operating in the largest Jamaican diaspora city in the world? By 1988, the answer had become a British problem. British police moved on him. He was arrested, deported. The deportation was not the end. It was a relocation. He found his way to Canada. In 1990, he was arrested again, this time for immigration fraud and assault. The aliases had not been enough. The borders were narrowing. But something had already happened between the arrest and the deportation. Something that changed what the British public believed about the Jamaican criminal presence in their country. He had appeared on The Cook Report. The Cook Report was British investigative television at its most confrontational. A program built to put subjects on camera in situations they could not control. Rankin Dredd's appearance on the program confirmed, for a national British audience, not just that he existed, but that he was operating openly, that the Yardie network was real, and that British law enforcement had a problem it had not fully grasped yet. The newspapers gave him a title: the most dangerous man in Britain, the number one Yardie godfather. These were media words, and media words always contain some inflation, but they were not invented from nothing. They were built on what the investigation had confirmed. The music stopped. The man remained. By this point, the British Yardie problem had grown into something the Metropolitan Police could not manage with the tools they had. It would take until 1998, 2 years after Rankin Dredd's death, for Operation Trident to be formally established as a Metropolitan Police unit specifically tasked with addressing gun crime disproportionately affecting black communities in London. Gun crime, with direct roots in the Yardie infrastructure that men like Rankin Dredd had laid down in the 1980s. He did not live to see Trident, but Trident was, in part, his inheritance to the city that had taken him in and could not get rid of him. He was extradited back to Jamaica. The exact details of the extradition are not extensively documented in the public record, but the destination is confirmed. He went back to the island that had made him, to a prison on the same soil where he had first learned what power looked like. And in 1996, inside that prison, Winston Brown, Ranking Dread, Errol Coddlin, Michael Dix, the most dangerous man in Britain, the number one Yardie Godfather, died. The official account says poisoning. Some in the circles that knew him best have never fully accepted that. Some say he did not die in that cell. Some say he walked out of it. The story of Ranking Dread ends the same way it began, with a question in the back of a room that nobody standing in the front row thought to ask. The answer died with him or disappeared with him, depending on which version you believe. What is not disputed is what he left behind. He left behind a city that had been changed. Hackney was not the same city in 1996 that it had been when he arrived in 1978. The Yardie presence he had helped build in those streets, in those clubs, in those networks moving cannabis and then crack cocaine through communities that had no political voice and no official protection, had become embedded. It had taken root the way things take root in communities already stretched by poverty and institutional neglect, quietly, deeply, and in ways that a single arrest or deportation or extradition could not undo. Men who had been teenagers on those streets when Ranking Dread was operating were now running their own operations. The blueprint he laid down did not require him to maintain it. The music had been the entry point. The microphone had been the introduction. The sound system had given him credibility with a community that trusted it. And he had used that credibility to build something the community could not easily remove once it was in place. That is the architecture that made him dangerous. Not the gun, not the violence, but the understanding that trust, once established, can be leveraged for things that have nothing to do with what it was built on. Winston Brown knew that in Rima. He proved it in London. And the cost of that proof is still being counted in the streets of the city that watched him perform and never saw what was coming. That was the story of Ranking Dread. If this episode moved you, if it taught you something, if it kept you up, share it. Follow us if you have not already, and stay close, because on the next episode of Jamaican Gangster, we are going somewhere you are not ready for.